This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Bruce Dixon says barbarians in blue uniforms threaten civilization. The same people who want to silence Mumia Abu-Jamal would also like to keep your mouth shut. And a people's lawyer says, beware of grand juries. But first, President Obama and the parents of slain Black teenager Michael Brown both favor putting body cameras on cops. The president wants to spend $75 million fitting cameras on police. However, Shahid Buttar, executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, says body cameras are a danger to civil liberties, allowing police to increase their surveillance of Black and poor communities. And, he says, they don't do much to prevent police lawlessness. However, Buttar understands why Michael Brown's family has endorsed body cameras for police.
When Michael Brown died, there was a dispute about the facts, and his parents wanted more transparency into that particular incident. And I, of course, obviously understand their wish as parents affected by a particular incident. But the problem is this: it's not transparency into individual incidents that has been the problem. We've had that. The video of Eric Garner's death at the hands of NYPD officers who used an illegal force method in broad daylight on video, accessible by and accessed by thousands of members of the public, even that wasn't enough to achieve accountability. And so it raises the concern that there are really two problems that body cameras, at the very least, distract from. And that's first, transparency into patterns and practices, which are critical, and no one has any idea about the empirical data around patterns and practices unless local bodies like city councils or state legislatures require their police departments to collect and then disclose the data, and that has happened in very few places. So that's one problem. The other problem that body cameras distract from is accountability, whether for discrete incidents or whether for patterns and practices. Without accountability, the transparency can't be enough, whether into individual incidents or the patterns and practices. And the kicker, which you alluded to, Glenn, is that even if you take aside those more important needs beyond transparency into individual incidents, what that transparency is going to give is the state more evidence to prosecute people in criminal court. And so body cameras will ultimately, I think, be used to create a mountain of new evidence that will fuel mass incarceration. And if people are concerned beyond individual incidents of police brutality with the broader phenomenon of mass incarceration, the school-to-prison pipeline, the war on people of color that has been going on in the United States for, unfortunately, hundreds of years, body cameras are not only not part of the solution, but they are an active setback, and I dare say a red herring that could very much subvert the movement and undermine its aims.
Yes, mass Black incarceration begins with hyper-surveillance of the Black community.
That's right, and that's another piece that body cameras extend, is not only the illusion of transparency without it in fact, but these are cameras that are monitoring people without any individualized basis for suspicion. And police need that if they're going to actually search you. But once body cameras are in place, that won't be necessary at all. It will extend the state's eyes and ears beyond your cell phone and beyond the cameras on the light towers at each intersection onto the uniforms of every police officer. And all that those cameras perceive will be available for uses in criminal trials. And realize a lot of these offenses that people have to face charges for are not very serious, right? I mean, what Eric Garner was suspected of, the reason he was killed on the street by NYPD agents, was the suspicion of selling loose cigarettes. And so those sorts of crimes, these low-level infractions that shouldn't probably be crimes in the first place, those are the kinds of things that body cameras will capture. And they'll capture not only evidence to be used in criminal trials, but they'll capture evidence of the pretextual offenses that then give rise to subsequent searches or uses of force that cops can then rely on to justify their actions. I think the community's response to the events in Ferguson and elsewhere is critically important. And I see in the president's proposal, unfortunately, a very dangerous threat.
Yes, you point out what is obvious, that the cameras are not pointed at the police, they're pointed outward, at the public.
And at the faceless public, right? It would be one thing even if the cameras were somehow focused on the person in front of the police officer. Then at least it's limited to the object of supposed suspicion or whoever the officer is interacting with. But if these cameras are fisheyes, for instance, you put a fisheye lens on a person's uniform, it's their entire field of vision. That is worse from a constitutional standpoint than a regime when there's no information at all. And let's be clear, in a lot of these cases, it's not the case that there's no video of events. It's that people get arrested when they try to capture it on their phones, right? If we're really that interested into transparency, into discrete acts, the best thing for us to do, instead of hurling $250 million at police departments, the best thing to do is to prohibit those police departments from arresting citizens, residents, who capture police activities on their phones. If you go on the corner now in a lot of parts of the country and you try to videotape a cop, you will risk arrest, not for a legitimate offense, but for a police officer or disrupting an officer's activities. You know, these are contrived offenses the police used. And if we're really concerned about video and transparency into discrete acts, the answer is not to put body cameras on police. It's to keep police from arresting people who use their cameras to watch them. So it's this very clever sleight of hand that I see happening. And then maybe the last piece to touch on here, it's not just the case that communities around the country are hyper-policed. They're also hyper-policed and deprived and starved of resources. And the $250 million that the president can mobilize to throw at police departments to further inflate their budgets in response to their latest civil rights abuses could be put to much better use in job training programs, youth counseling programs, after-school programs, resources for communities that have been clamoring for them for years for opportunities and alternatives to the school-to-prison pipeline. That's where any resources that come from the White House's slush funds in response to the Black Lives Matter, that's where those resources should go, not back into the budgets of police departments.
Throughout the article, you hammer home the idea that cameras should not be substitutes, certainly, for real reform. And you point to a bill called the End Racial Profiling Act that has been languishing in Congress since the turn of the 21st century, even through those years when Democrats held control of both houses of Congress.
Yes, indeed. And the history on the End Racial Profiling Act is an ongoing scandal that, in particular, Democrats should feel ashamed of. This is a bill that was endorsed by President George W. Bush. It was not enacted because essentially 9/11 took everybody's eyes off the ball and Congress didn't do much other than anti-terrorism legislation that year. And Congress never went back to the well, even after the first black president with the nation's first black attorney general come to Washington, having worked on, in President Obama's case, his signature achievement before winning the presidency, was getting a racial profiling bill through the Illinois State Senate. And in the time that President Obama has been the chief executive of the federal government, HRPA has continued to remain under the congressional bus. It's particularly interesting if you look at the most recent session of Congress, that go in two-year sessions. It didn't even get a single hearing. And that was a session in which Democrats held the Senate and the White House. And no one's talking about the measure that has been lying around in plain sight for over a decade now, that would actually, you know, it's hard to say any law is going to fix the problem, but it would take real steps forward, way beyond body cameras. What the End Racial Profiling Act would require is, first, for police departments that receive federal funds to disclose, first to collect, and then to analyze and disclose the impacts of their investigative activities, the searches, the stops, the uses of force, to disclose how those investigatory activities impact particular populations, like, for instance, African Americans, or people who don't have a home to go to at night, right? There are different kinds of populations that are vulnerable to police bias. And unless the police themselves collect the data and provide it to policymakers and the public and the press, no one knows how bad the profiling epidemic really is. And I think any of us who've been on the unfortunate side of a police encounter know how prevalent and pervasive profiling has become. But a lot of other people don't. If you live in a gated community and you go to work in a car and you work in an office building and that's the extent of your interaction with the universe beyond your house, right, you might well not have any idea that in major cities in America, low-income communities of color have been essentially struggling with armed occupation for decades. The other thing that the Anti Racial Profiling Act does, which body cameras conspicuously do not, is provide accountability. And this is important. The way IRPA does it is clever and somewhat ingenious. It creates a right of private action, meaning anyone who's impacted by profiling can take the incident before a judge. Just provides access to justice, nothing more. Though the standard under which it provides access to justice is a big deal, because now, today, under current federal law, if you want to establish a profiling claim under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, you have to show not only that you were discriminated against, but specifically that the particular government official is not interested in the performance of their duties. IRPA would change that so that the statistics could be used as evidence in themselves, and that's critical because it's the only way that we can find out as a people if this systemic offense is happening, and there's a crux there that's worth teasing out. Michael Brown's parents were responding to an assault and the murder of their son. Obviously, that is a grievous, heinous assault, and we should all be concerned about it. What I think a lot of us are concerned about is not merely the assault on particular individuals, but the ongoing assault on entire communities. And the only way to attack that, the only way to stop profiling, as opposed to discrete acts, is to collect the data, disclose the data. It's exactly what the Anti Racial Profiling Act would do, and that's exactly why Congress and the President need to finally do their jobs and get it enacted into law.
So in a nutshell, body cameras just take pictures of people, but legislation such as the End Racial Profiling Act actually empower people.
That's exactly right. And it empowers people not by complex regulatory schemes. It just gives us access to the courts to protect our rights. And a lot of people have this debate. I see it on social media every day. Are cops racist or not? And maybe it's a productive conversation. I'm much more interested in learning, in this neighborhood, how bad is the profiling epidemic, and let's stop it. And the only way that doesn't, you know, quite frankly, the individual acts in that frame of reference, they're certainly important. And I think the statistics can help us identify who are the bad cops, right? The way to get to meaningful officer accountability is through department accountability. And we need to be looking at the department level, not just the officer level. And we need to be looking at solutions, not just lip service.
Or else we're encouraged to examine the problem through the lens of the rogue cop rather than a whole system of policing gone wrong.
Yeah, you hear a lot of people talk about bad apples. And unfortunately, you know, you put the death of Michael Brown together with the death of Eric Garner, together with the death of Tamir Rice, together with, you know, and there have been subsequent incidents since then. You know, if it's a bad apple, there must be an entire orchard of them, because unfortunately, it's a lot more than one death. And for every murder of an unarmed person that you hear about by police, there are 1,000 kids who were thrown against the wall for no reason and terrified that they're going to be the next one. And all they were doing is walking home from school. It's so much bigger than merely the death of innocent people en masse. I mean, we're talking about the terrorization of entire communities. And, it, you know, the worst part of all this, I think, for people who are new to these issues, is that these issues aren't new. This defines the experience in the United States of entire communities of people. And unfortunately, that's something we have to grapple with as a nation, and we haven't even started to. But one very exciting thing I see in the movement to achieve police accountability is that all of the various races and ages and even styles, I've noticed people coming together in the Black Lives Matter movement. I've been in St. Louis on the ground, in New York and D.C. There are people from every walk of life, young college kids from every race, older retirees from every race. It's been amazing to be at some of these community town halls where you see parents who've lost their kids to police violence. There was one in Brooklyn a few weeks ago. There was one at the Justice Department just before that. And these are people speaking from their own direct experience. And, you know, in some cases, it just, it really pulls your heart out to hear what these families have had to endure. And with no justice for years. I heard from a father in Brooklyn who lost his son in the 1990s to NYPD officers. And there was an allegation at that event that the reason his son was targeted was because he'd been at a protest after the death of Amadou Diallo. He was at an Amadou Diallo protest after the fact of his death at the NYPD. You know, so it just gets worse and worse. But I think now, maybe because of the transparency that pocket phones and camera phones have enabled, we're having a debate that we should have had 100 years ago. You know, in some respects, we are right now dealing with issues we thought we fixed in the Civil War, but unfortunately remain very much live issues in urban areas in every corner of the country from the south to the north.
Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Civil liberties lawyers say a new Pennsylvania law that was designed to silence political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal also threatens the rights of countless others inside and outside the nation's prison system. The so-called Silencing Act allows victims of crime to bring suit, charging that they've been caused mental anguish by the words of people convicted of crimes. Brett Grote is executive director of the Abolitionist Law Center, which is joined in seeking an injunction against enforcement of the Silencing Act. Grote says Mumia isn't the only one whose free speech is endangered.
The act is chilling free speech. It's causing actual self-censorship, and our plaintiffs, in particular Mumia Abu-Jamal and those who, like Prison Radio or Educators from Mumia, rely on communications with him, they face the threat of enforcement under this act, and given the irreparable injury that they're suffering because of the chill of their First Amendment rights, we are entitled to relief in a preliminary fashion that will prevent the defendants from enforcing this act.
Well, certainly Mumia Abu-Jamal has not censored himself since this act was passed by the Pennsylvania legislature. Who are your other clients, and how are they being chilled in terms of their ability to express themselves?
Just to start with Mumia, even though he has continued his journalistic output, that is being threatened in various ways. So one of our other clients are the Educators from Mumia Abu-Jamal, a collection of academics, law professors, intellectuals, educators who advocate for Mumia, for his release from prison, and also to bring the voices of incarcerated people into educational settings. One of the co-coordinators of Educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal, Mark Taylor, who's a Christian theologian who teaches at the Princeton Theological Seminary, in December was instructed by his administrators to not have Mumia call into his class, which is something Mr. Taylor has done frequently in the past, in light of the new legislation pending a legal review by the institution's attorneys. And that was just completed yesterday, and Mr. Taylor was told it is now acceptable for him to call Mumia in. But nonetheless, he had to wait more than a month. It impeded his ability to plan his curriculum for the coming semester, and it places a burden on educators like Mr. Taylor to have to go submit their curricula to legal review under this new law. Other clients include imprisoned writers and activists like Robert Selene Holbrook. They carry Shakabuna Marshall. Mr. Marshall is a juvenile lifer. He spent 27 years in prison. He's an activist. He's also a commentator for Prison Radio. He works with the Human Rights Coalition, an abolitionist organization in Pennsylvania. He has currently put on hold an autobiographical work he is writing out of concern that discussion of his crime, the crime of his conviction and his trial and his experiences in prison could trigger an enforcement action. And there's a couple of other plaintiffs, Donnell Palmer and Anthony Chance, who are incarcerated activists, writers, serving life sentences. And Mr. Chance has two forthcoming fiction books that he is in the process of publishing right now, and he is now going to do those under pseudonyms so that these works do not trigger an enforcement action as well. There's also Prison Radio, who are the producers of Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries. Prison Radio, since 2002, has produced commentaries that have been regularly picked up by Free Speech Radio News, and subsequent to the Mumia Abu-Jamal has been the leading op-ed contributor for Free Speech Radio News. Subsequent to the passage of this act, Free Speech Radio News made it concerned that they are wary of this new law, and they are concerned they could be held legally liable for airing Abu-Jamal's commentaries. And since the governor of Pennsylvania, the outgoing governor, signed this act, they have not aired Mumia on their weekly edition programs. They placed him once, one of his commentaries, on their website, but he hasn't been aired on their weekly program, which is sent to stations all over the country. And we consider all of this evidence of the chilling effect that this law not only is having, but was very explicitly intended to have.
Yes, we see the Silencing Act has broad and wide sweep. You mentioned one inmate who has anxieties about writing an autobiography, that is, writing about his own actual life, and another who has fears about writing fiction. It seems that both fiction and fact are subject to be silenced under this act.
Absolutely. If somebody wanted to bring an enforcement action, whether it's somebody who has been the victim of a personal injury crime or whether it's a district attorney or the attorney general bringing it on their behalf, there's really only two things that they need to prove under this act to silence the person who they're bringing the action against. One is that the person engaged in conduct. So conduct is not narrowed, it's not defined, it's not limited in any sense. So writing fiction, writing a memoir, or any other of a range of what are just core constitutionally protected free speech activities fall under that heading. And the other thing they have to show is that it caused them emotional distress.
Seems that the word conduct can cover just about anything, like striking a certain posture in a picture.
Yeah, certainly. There were a photograph of somebody in prison giving the symbol of the Black Liberation Struggle, you know, the fist in the air, right? That could cause mental anguish for a victim who thinks that this person is trying to garner sympathy as a political or politicized prisoner, when in the eyes of the victim, they are just trying to fool people and deceive people as to who they truly are, something to that effect. There are no limiting principles in the law. And interestingly, we've obtained a number of emails that show that that was exactly how it was intended to be written. Some of these are included in the declaration of Noel Hanrahan through Pennsylvania's Right to Know Act. There were some emails obtained to and from the Commonwealth's victims advocate, and the victims advocate, Jennifer Storm, had been discussing with various parties leading up to and after the passage of this act what it was intended to do. And only 2 days after the act, she is writing emails about how an unidentified person wanted to bring a test case under the new law in order to shut down Mumia's weekly radio commentaries, and also wanted to stop the publication of his two forthcoming books in 2015, and she was soliciting legal advice on these particular issues.
Now, there is a certain cohort in the United States that favors any measures that would make prison inmates miserable and would like to shut them away in silence and pain forever. But this Silencing Act impacts not just people behind bars, but people on the outside who have not been convicted of any crime at all. How can that be? How can a law be configured that is designed to silence prison inmates and winds up silencing people on the outside as well?
Well, it can't be, is our argument, is that this is illegal, it's transparently illegal, and that it was passed without really much consideration as to whether or not it would withstand judicial scrutiny. But the discussion in the House Judiciary Committee of Pennsylvania in passing the law explicitly addressed whether or not the Silencing Act would permit a judge to enjoin the conduct of what they refer to as third-party vessels, such as prison radio, right? And it was envisioned as doing so. That is something that is in the legislative record. The text of the statute is silent on the matter, but it is written in such a vague and expansive manner that the only way to obtain the injunctive relief that somebody may seek under this act, such as shutting down Mumia's weekly radio commentaries, would require courts to bring the conduct of third parties like prison radio educators from Mumia under its authority. Additionally, it's not just prisoners that the act silences, but anybody convicted of a personal injury crime. And just today, this morning, the same day we filed this preliminary injunction motion, the American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of this act, also against the state attorney general, Kathleen Kane, and the Philadelphia district attorney, Seth Williams, with, I think, about 11 other plaintiffs. Those include people who are former prisoners, people who have been convicted of crimes, who can be held liable under this act. The caption of that case is Prison Legal News versus Kane, and that was also filed in the Middle District of Pennsylvania.
And so this is why you've assembled a range of plaintiffs to challenge the Silencing Act, people who are behind bars and people who are not.
Yeah, between our case and the other that was just filed today, I mean, you have quite a diverse spectrum of people. You have those who are incarcerated, you have those who are formerly incarcerated, you have educators from the high school to the postgraduate levels, you have law professors, you have theologians, you have journalists, a number of journalists and journalistic entities, you have human rights organizations, prison abolitionist organizations, and you have others who, you know, are in the prison or outside of the prison who are attempting to do, you know, various programs of community uplift, and all of them are encompassed by this really unprecedented statute. The language that was used by the Commonwealth's victims advocate was that she was told it was innovative and unique, and it certainly would be an innovation on the First Amendment, one that would essentially eviscerate it and leave it subject to the whims of literally millions of people who have been subject to personal injury crimes, along with dozens of state prosecutors, and they would have veto power on any conduct engaged in by anybody ever convicted of a personal injury crime, from a misdemeanor assault all the way up to, you know, the most serious of offenses.
And you will be arguing that the state legislature intended that it would have this effect.
There is evidence in these emails that it was written as broadly as could be to sweep in as much potential conduct. There is evidence in the legislative record that it was written broadly so that a judge would have discretion as to when that should be and should not be enforced. And this is something the Supreme Court has routinely struck down whenever what they call standardless discretionary authority is vested in a government official. Usually it's, say, somebody who is given the responsibility for issuing a permit, you know, for a march or for some type of activity, right? And there is no discretion to guide that person. It is a situation in which censorship and arbitrary decision-making is enabled, and it's likely to flourish. And there's no difference here wherever the standardless nature is vested in a court or in those, you know, bringing the action itself, the crime victim or the prosecutors. It's not only something that enables discriminatory enforcement, but was intended to do so. And there really is no other way they could have written the statute, because the whole purpose of it was to target Mumia Abu-Jamal, whose conduct has been recognized by the courts as constitutionally protected. So the only way to get a court to be able to censor that is to write an unconstitutional law.
That was Brett Grote of the Abolitionist Law Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mumia Abu-Jamal is serving a life sentence at the state prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania, where he continues to produce commentaries and analysis for Prison Radio.
It's been over a decade since the U.S. launched its crusade against the forces of evil in the East. And it has only succeeded in creating disaster after disaster, and more enemies than we could count. It has consistently backed governments in the Arab world that could double as the mafia, that rule by repression, torture, and the divine right of kings. It has mouthed words of democracy, and just as quickly swallowed them whole, as their chosen allies have rode roughshod over their people, fighting them like foreign enemies. Israel has been armed and unleashed to torment the Palestinians into submission to so-called peace deals that would make the Vichy French blush with shame. And while they have spent over $1 trillion to stitch together their bevy of indigenous allies, things bubble on a caldera of lava, and social forces rage with contempt and hatred for their rulers. Things are not well either in the Middle East or at home, for the crowns of neocolonialism do not sit easily on the heads of U.S. allies. The wasted billions and hundreds of billions, the thousands of soldiers dead, equally wasted, the wasted hopes of the invaded and the occupied. Wars have a way of returning home in the most unexpected of ways. We're seeing that now in France. Perhaps we shall see it here as well.
Political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. While public intellectuals like Mumia languish in prison, the streets are left to the tender mercies of men with guns in uniform. Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon says, beware of the barbarians in blue.
There's a potent and powerful racist and classist myth that tough cops, jailers, judges, and prosecutors are all that stand between us and rampant crime, anarchy, and ruin. For American politics, it's an increasingly necessary fantasy, a myth that generations of public officials, from jailing judges and hang-'em-high prosecutors to lock-'em-up legislators, sheriffs, governors, and even presidents, have based their careers upon. The myths are necessary because no modern society can openly abandon its duty to provide its people quality educations, decent housing, living wage jobs, and economic security, unless it is willing to brand large numbers of those to whom it won't provide education or housing or jobs and a dignified retirement unworthy, undeserving, and irredeemable. The American political class of both parties, including black politicians, stopped even talking about any rights to full employment, decent housing, and economic security and the like a generation ago, preferring to pretend that there is no alternative. Thus the myths of the trifling, lazy, drug-addled, crime-ridden, mostly black and brown poor are essential to the stability of America as we know it. These myths are the ethical and the moral justification of the neoliberal economic order and its prison state. Over-policing and mass incarceration don't just happen because the cops are racist, the prosecutors corrupt, and the legislators and media vicious and cowardly, nor because they're driven by the profits of private prisons or captive labor. America's savage police and prison states provide us with a long-running reality show that justifies our profoundly unequal and unjust social order. They give us a morality play that casts the criminalized and mostly non-white poor as villains, kept at bay by the heroism of that thin blue line, while schools, roads, parks, public works, nature, and even water are privatized, while private and public pensions are looted, while student loan debt, black unemployment, and underemployment continue to rise, and while wages continue to fall, while child homelessness is at an all-time high and there are more vacant homes than homeless people, and while the rich and famous are celebrated and lionized for being famously rich. This is something that politicians from the president down to local mayors and aldermen know, and top cops from Homeland Security and the FBI to state and local departments know as well. It's something those in motion in the streets today over the last dozen and the next dozen police atrocities must better understand and articulate. The burgeoning movement against police immunity and impunity really is a threat to so-called national security, a menace to the privileges of banksters and employers, of privatizers and gentrifiers, the prerogatives of the 1%. When more of them openly question these prerogatives in the same breaths as they do the privilege of cops to murder and maim with immunity and impunity, will be a long step closer to a better world.
Bar Managing Editor Bruce Dixon speaking from Atlanta. People's lawyer Lynn Stewart has been back home in Brooklyn for a year now after spending 4 years in federal prison for the crime of zealously defending her client on terrorism charges. Stewart is suffering from stage 4 cancer and has been barred from acting or speaking as a lawyer. However, she recently wrote an article warning of the evils of U.S. grand juries. in the wake of a grand jury's failure to indict the cop who killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, it sometimes sounds as if people in the movement would like to see an even more aggressive grand jury system. But Lynn Stewart says grand juries are not the place to find justice.
The grand jury is really the star chamber of our day. If I can use that analogy, you know, the star chamber, which basically just convicted people in old England and set off with your head. Of course, it was born out of great discontent on the part of the nobles. Nobles only, men, white, old, privileged, who were being thrown into jail by the king because he could just get rid of them that way. You know, goodbye, now I'll take your castle. So they revolted, and that revolt ended up with the Magna Carta, which, of course, people tout as being, you know, one of the beginning documents of liberty. But really, it was, once again, like all the other documents of liberty, liberty for a very limited few and very limited liberty for them even. But now to have it transmogrified into being this vehicle by which we can seek justice against police who are literally murderers, as urged on by prosecuting officials, it really does smack. It's the most hypocritical in the extreme, because on the one hand, it's saying we have to go after these guys and we're going to present this evidence to the grand jury, and on the other hand, knowing that the way in which it's presented and by whom it's presented will mean that there'll be no voting of any kind of charges.
Yes, and in the grand jury proceeding, there is no presentation of what you call the opposition scenario, that is, the scenario of the defendant.
Exactly. A defendant may appear, of course, as I said in my short piece, in our cases, the tragedy is the defendants are dead. They're not able to appear and tell their side of the story, even if they were permitted. But where those rare occasions where defendants do appear, they are only permitted to present their position. Their lawyer is not permitted to take any active part whatsoever. In other words, he can't stay in the grand jury room and cross-examine witnesses after the DA. That is verboten. And if you want to do that, counselor, you'll have to go to trial. Well, that's what should happen, in my view.
And, of course, the grand jury is a tool of the prosecutor. In a national security state such as the one we live under now, grand juries have been used with vicious effect on the opposition, on progressives, on those who oppose the national security state and imperial wars.
No question about it, Glenn. And, you know, we all have our worst-case scenarios. What's the worst case? One of the ones I hold so close to my heart was the murder of two young men who were shot when they were face down in an apartment in the Bronx. And the grand jury came back with justifiable homicide. And that was made into a documentary showing all the proof that it was a homicide, but it sure wasn't justifiable. There are so many of these, and it goes back so far. And as I say, the grand jury is just another tool in their arsenal, as if they needed more. But it is another tool. It's an imprimatur. It's something that says, look, we're going by the law. Of course, so did the Nazis. Everything they did was according to law. And this is the same scenario. We're doing it according to the law. You can have no argument. And they expect people not to stand up and say, law, what law? You know, whose law? When was this law? You know, so definitely it's outside the realm.
Now, in St. Louis, the grand jury was a tool of the prosecutor, Bob McCullough, a tool for non-prosecution.
In the way the grand jury operates, there are grand juries and there are special grand juries. It's very interesting to me right now because, and I don't even know if I'm allowed to reveal this, but my granddaughter is sitting on a special grand jury and she has a billion questions, of course, about what she's doing because they have no idea. They just basically sit there and they roll this evidence past them. So then there's grand juries and they basically have traditionally, in New York State anyway, and it's not used so much in every state, but New York State, it is the main way in which a defendant is brought before the court. And they basically, they just roll the cop in, the cop says, and cop talk, rolls out again, and then they take a vote, and they vote, you know, an indictment. And then that is what the person must answer to in front of a judge in a court of law. And that's when the trial process begins, or I should say the plea process, because there are no such thing as trials anymore. Everybody has to plead. Everybody gets a deal, so-called. But at any rate, what is so not remarkable, but so opprobrious about the process by which they present a case against a cop is that it's decided ahead of time that, of course, the cop will not be indicted, that, of course, it will not operate in the usual way, that is, he'll be brought on for trial, but that he will be exonerated either by reason of no true bill, meaning there's not enough evidence, or that it was justifiable, which is really a leap in most of these cases, absolutely.
As you describe it, it sounds to me like the grand jury is a bunch of citizens who are there simply to give legitimacy to the prosecutor.
I think you've nailed it, Glenn. That's exactly what it is. And also, up to the rest of us. The rest of us are then supposed to be able to say, well, they presented it to, 28 people, 24 people. It must be okay if they went along with it. They wouldn't have gone along. Sometimes we get this phenomenon, which hasn't been seen in a long time now, of, quote, a runaway grand jury. And the runaway grand jury takes the case from the prosecutor and starts going its own way, really evaluating evidence, really making decisions, really voting the way it should be voted. But that, as I say, is a phenomenon that hasn't happened, I would say, in the last 20 years.
You're advocating that the grand jury system should be abolished. Would it leave a hole or not?
Well, only if, you know, as I mentioned in my short piece, there are cases, and I've been fortunate enough to represent people on them, where the defendant's account of what happened, usually a self-defense case, where he says to the grand jury, look, this is what happened, I went this, and they vote against the prosecutor, they vote no true bill. So in those very rare occasions, I would say in my 30 years of practice, I can only remember two or three cases where that ever happened. There are some cases where they voted both ways. They voted what they would call up and down. In other words, I don't know whether anybody listening will remember the case of Yunus Muhammad, who was after our friend, in quote, small letter, big F, Giuliani made a speech against Dinkins, calling him a washroom attendant when he was mayor of the city. After Giuliani did that, this kid was on the subway, and he accidentally tripped a cop who was drunk and coming back from a rally. And this cop then, along with his buddies, beat this kid senseless. He was a very slight kid. You know, when I say slight, he was small. Anyway, to make a long story short, that particular case was presented to the grand jury. We presented our side, which we had witnessed in saying that the cops had hit first and that it was their badness. The cop attacked him. He retaliated with a box cutter. The box cutter gave the cop 130 stitches. The cops then dragged him off the subway, the Franklin Avenue shuttle, and bounced him down the stairs, head bouncing on each stair as he went down. He ultimately lost partial sight in one eye, and you can imagine his state the next day when we were called in to represent him. His jaws were wired. I mean, it was a terrible, it was an awful beating, but we did put him in the grand jury, Yunus Muhammad, and the cop went in the grand jury too, and they both got indicted. Now, Yunus went to trial and ultimately ended up with a hung jury. The cop, he was not charged with serious felonies, whatever it was. nor were his buddies. But that was at least a fair presentation by the DA, because she presented both sides equally and asked the grand jury to decide who was the bad guy in this. And they've said they both were bad, which, of course, really was not true. But at any rate, that's another aspect. So when you say, do I think the grand jury should be abolished? I do. I think it's an anachronism. I think it puts another roadblock in the way of people looking at a case and deciding it. I think it's a way in which the prosecution has continued to keep the playing field, if you can call it that, and to some degree law and trial is a playing field. It's kept the playing field for itself. It controls all the moves. And one of those moves is certainly the grand jury. And to me, at least looking at the big picture of it all, it seems the grand jury should be abolished.
Going back to Missouri, Bob McCullough, the prosecutor, could convene another grand jury and have another swipe at former officer Darren Wilson. But I don't know if people would advocate that Bob McCullough be in charge of that process again. But what about the feds? What options do they have regarding Darren Wilson open to them right now?
Well, I think it's extremely interesting, and we've been watching it with interest. The grand juror who wants to be able to speak out, in other words, he wants to pierce the secrecy of the grand jury and say what really went on in there. And I think that's a very healthy sign, and we'll see whether or not in supposedly a system that's supposed to be open and honest, a court will sustain his request for that. That could be the beginning of the end of the grand jury if they do, if he is permitted to speak out. I doubt very much that the DA in St. Louis County will represent the case. He's where he wants to be. He's in the catbird seat. He has no desire to reopen this can of worms, believe you me. So he will sit pat unless something happens that forces his hand. And, I don't see much out there. But you never can tell. That's what we live in interesting times, Glenn. May we live in interesting times.
Is there anything interesting that the federal government, the U.S. Justice Department, could do, not what it will do, but could do regarding Darren Wilson?
Well, the past has shown us that the federal government, while they have power to do things, they rarely seize that power. And I think that mainly any power they may have is just the power to continue to do wrong. They are not really suited to. They have brought, I will say, certainly there was a case of Anthony Baez in the Bronx, a young man who was playing football and the ball hit the cop car, and they ended up killing him. And his family did sue, and his mother is one of our big advocates against police brutality, Iris Baez, and they did win a federal lawsuit on basis that his civil rights had been denied. But when you start talking about civil rights, where someone has been murdered, you've already lost 10 steps. I'm sorry. It's just like going for the basket, you know. You're at half court and they're down under the basket. They're not going to pursue that in the same way they would pursue a true criminal prosecution. And so, yes, the federal government can do things. It has in the past, but rarely is it successful.
Is it rarely successful because of the obstacles, or is it rarely successful because of the will and resources that the federal government dedicates to it?
I think it's definitely both. I think it's difficult because, you know, at a certain point people don't want to hear about this anymore, but I think it also is, this is not the case that's going to make a career for a young prosecutor. He's not going from here to some schmarmy Wall Street firm where he's going to be a big deal. You know, there's very few Ramsey Clarks left in our world that go forward and become more militant as they get older and older. So I think that it's both. It's a will on the part of the prosecutor's office plus the actual resources to do a case like that.
You, of course, have been a defender of the people, whether they are engaged in political pursuits or just going about their lives. Do you think that the lawyerly profession is more or less important today in terms of the politics of movements than it was in previous years, given that the political climate and the rules as laid down by the Supreme Court have changed?
You put me in a tough position, Glenn, because, you know, my restrictions being disbarred are probably some of the most opprobrious you can imagine. I'm not even allowed to go into my son and daughter's law offices and file papers for them. I have to stay away from all aspects of the law. I have basically interpreted that to mean it doesn't mean commenting on what I think about the situation. And, of course, I've been to many law schools and talked to young lawyers and urged them, you know, to stick with why they became lawyers, even in the face of what they are facing in terms of owing government, owing the banks, the banksters, this ton of money for being the privilege of becoming a lawyer. I think that there's still fire in the belly out there. There's still young people who want to do this work because they know it's the right thing to do, and they know if they don't do it, there's no one else that's going to do it. And that is very, very important. And, you know, it does range from people just fair beating on the subway to those who are murdering their hedge fund father. But the gamut of crime is very wide and is a real challenge to make sure that people get treated fairly, and particularly political people. And I think we're going to see more and more with the closing down now of Grand Central Station as a vicinage for people to put on a demonstration that is really paid attention to and noticed. And I think they're going to crack down on any kind of demonstration type things. And this, of course, I think is in response to the cops being mad at de Blasio. He's going to give them an inch there. So, listen, I think that the law today has a long way to go. I think that people, lawyers in particular, are frightened. I think my case scared an awful lot of people. Here was me just doing what I was supposed to be doing, and I ended up doing 5 years in jail. So there are all kinds of impediments, but I do know there are the good people out there that continue to do the good thing, carry on the good fight, and I have faith that they will continue to do that. I also have to say that it's not easy in this climate to do that.
And in your case, it's not easy to even give the kind of analysis that you'd like to. But even under restrictions, your analysis is far better than those who are not so encumbered. This past weekend in St. Louis, there convened a Black people's grand jury, that is 12 local people from Ferguson and elsewhere in greater St. Louis, Black folks, and 4 people acting as prosecutors who proceeded to indict Darren Wilson for first-degree murder. What do you think about the merits of these kinds of exercises of Black folks' self-determination and autonomy regarding the justice system?
I think my short answer is they are exercises. Of course, they aren't the real thing. But on the other hand, they do bring a certain degree of light and clarity to things that wasn't there before. So if there are people that can learn from that, if there are people in that audience who are listening and say, oh, that's how it works. Oh, you mean if we were in charge of our own institutions, i.e. a grand jury, we could indict, we could carry this thing. That, I think, is valuable. Anything that empowers people or lets them know that were they to become a part of a community that has a certain degree of power, those things are valuable. They're valuable because they shed light where there is no light. And they're valuable because they demonstrate to a powerless community what it might be like had they the power to do something. And although it may not be able to go anywhere, it's still in the minds of people. It sets up a standard for which we may all try to aspire That standard, of course, one that I have fought for since 1962, being community control, where the community controls the institutions, and particularly those institutions that have to do with the prosecution of crime. And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.